The Take What Serves, Leave the Rest podcast is sponsored by Prairie Care. You know, going through the process of getting help with your mental health can be very overwhelming. I definitely know that from firsthand experience. Prairie Care can help guide you through it and get you in touch with the help that you need. They've been offering mental health services to all ages in the Twin Cities of Minnesota since 2005. Whether you're looking for clinical services, a specialty outpatient program, or a more intensive level of care like inpatient treatment, Prairie Care has you and your family covered. Visit prairie-care.com to learn more. That's prairie-care.com. Well, hello there, my friends, and welcome into another episode of the Take What Serves, Leave the Rest podcast. My name is Brian Pyatt, and welcome in, holding space as always for however you are showing up right here, right now, in this moment. So glad you're here and ready to dive into another episode. And this week, really looking forward to sharing this with all of you. You know, many people living with OCD can experience and do experience obsessions related to God, spirituality, religion, can get very, very consumed with making sure that they're doing things in alignment with God, experiencing a fear of offending God. And this can be a huge, huge thing that a lot of people are maneuvering. And I see this with a lot of people who are living with OCD. And I wanted to do an episode about it. And we're going to introduce and talk about some terms in this episode that I really don't think I've touched on here on the Take What Serves, Leave the Rest podcast before. And those terms are moral and religious scrupulosity. And to help us with this, we have the wonderful Reverend Katie O'Dunn joining us today. Katie is helping people integrate their faith with effective treatment for OCD, which is such important work. She is an ordained minister and interfaith chaplain. She is the founder and director of Stick With The Ick and lead advocate for the International OCD Foundation. She's also an endurance athlete. And listen to this. She's working towards doing 50 ultra marathons, one in each state, to raise awareness about OCD, which is incredible. And in this episode, we're going to talk about religious and moral scrupulosity, how this religion and this religious theme can latch on for people living with OCD. She shares her own journey of living with OCD. She talks about some of her doctoral research that has been all centered around reimagining effective treatment for obsessive compulsive disorder as a spiritual practice. And she talks about how she's seen people actually deepen their relationship with God through getting effective treatment. So let's go ahead and begin, my friends. As always, encourage you to take what serves you from this conversation and leave the rest. Sending big love to each and every one of you out there. One moment at a time, we journey forward, and let's go ahead and begin. Katie, thank you so much for joining me here on this episode. It is so good to have you on here.
Thank you. I am super excited just to have this conversation and for us to be able to reconnect. So thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, for everybody listening, we briefly met at the OCD Game Changers event in Denver, Colorado, literally days before the world shut down for COVID. So a lot has happened between then and now.
And we were just talking about before we got on recording how we were all there like, oh, nothing's going on. Nothing's going to happen. And we all know how wrong we were.
I'm so excited to not only learn more about the path that you've been on, the work that you're doing, but to also share with everyone listening the beautiful work that you are doing. How do you kind of, in a nutshell, before we do too much of a deep dive, I guess, like, describe what it is? Like, how do you describe your work to people?
Yeah. So I am a minister and a former school chaplain who has OCD, is really open about having OCD, and who wants folks to know that you can engage in beautifully authentic faith practices while seeking OCD treatment. My work revolves around this idea that we can, in fact, do evidence-based treatments for OCD, like ERP, and that those can serve as spiritual practices to help us stop worshiping OCD and actually connect with the divine in a way that's authentic to us in our life. So I work kind of at the intersection of these two spaces. I work between the clinical and the faith side to help clients, clinicians, and faith leaders navigate this intersection as they continue to move toward their values.
Yeah. And I think it would be really, really helpful right out of the gate. I know there's some people listening to this who are aware of what things like scrupulosity, you know, religious, moral scrupulosity, like what those things are, have maybe heard of things like religious themed OCD. Mm-hmm. For people who have never heard these terms before, mm-hmm. starting with, I guess, scrupulosity, mm-hmm. what is that?
Yeah. So I always, when I explain this, I always like to take a step back first and tell folks OCD is OCD is OCD, as I'm sure that we talk about often on this podcast. And it can show up. I always compare it to gross ice cream. OCD is really nasty ice cream that can come in a lot of different gross artificial flavors. And there are different challenges with all of those artificial flavors. One of those happens to be scrupulosity, whether it comes in the moral sense or the religious sense. And what that means is that your OCD is, of course, latching on to what's the most important to you, but it has to do with your morality. It has to do with your religious beliefs and with your religious practices. And when we say religious scrupulosity specifically, we're talking about when obsessions and compulsions go beyond what someone would normally be doing in their religious practice and start to take over life, where it's no longer about worshiping God or engaging or connecting in meaningful ways, but it's strictly from a place of feeling like we need to get relief from the fear, guilt, anxiety, shame that we're so used to with OCD. But with religious scrupulosity, that's coming in the form of religious practice. And to the untrained eye, can look like someone is really devout, but it's not why they're actually engaging in those things. In reality, it's directed by the disorder.
Okay. And this is something that you have your own personal lived experience with.
So it's actually really interesting that you asked that. So in some ways, yes, I have experience with OCD and really moral scrupulosity. I actually didn't find out about religious scrupulosity until I started to share my story and advocate. And was so surprised, this wasn't something we learned about in seminary, and ended up doing a whole pivot with my life to dedicating it to that work, because I was like, how are people not talking about this?
yeah. Okay. So your own personal journey with OCD, when did that start for you?
Yeah. So I've navigated OCD really since before I can remember. My earliest memories involved walking through our living room and touching things in a particular order to keep everyone safe. The earliest obsession I can remember was when I was in elementary school, our teacher telling us that the sun was going to get too close to the earth and everyone eventually was going to die. I'm sure she didn't say it in as scary a way as that, but that is how my brain interpreted that. And I felt like I needed to protect the world. And that by doing everything right, by touching things in a particular order, by erasing lines off of papers, that I was somehow protecting the world from ultimate doom of the sun getting too close. And that's the earliest obsession really that I can remember. And it started to grow into things of even feeling like I was responsible for the well-being of my elementary school classmates and my teachers. In third grade, I lost my aunt to cancer and I thought it was my fault. So I started to call my parents into my room every night and confess these worries and try to make sure that I wasn't responsible for bad things happening in the world. So they sent me to my first psychologist. And as many of us in the OCD world know, so many folks don't know what OCD is. They don't know how to treat OCD. So I was not diagnosed, did a lot of talk therapy, played a lot of checkers. And I pretended I got better because I wanted him to think he was good at his job. And I was afraid that he would get fired if I didn't. So I said, I don't have any worries anymore. They're gone. They're history. And that wasn't the case for me. They got bigger throughout my life. And I was able to mask those in different ways, both in unhealthy relationships and with substances and different things throughout high school. And getting into college, running for me became a really great outlet, but unfortunately not something, as we know, that can replace treatment. Evidence-based treatment is so important. To kind of fast track, what ended up happening is I got into seminary. I was someone who was really high functioning and had been great at not letting anyone know how many compulsions I was doing each and every day, how much time I was spending ruminating. And I hit seminary at Emory here in Atlanta doing my Master of Divinity. And it started to get really bad in my early 20s. I wasn't sleeping anymore. I was checking ovens, stoves, locks thousands of times. I was going down to the parking garage to make sure cars were safe. I was driving back. And this always, when I say this, it always sounds bananas, but I was driving back to churches where I was interning in the middle of the night and trying to break in to make sure candles were blown out. I'm like, wow, how did no one know that I was struggling at this point? So I was taking a course in psychology that kind of linked to a dual degree I was doing with public health and actually self-diagnosed with OCD. I was like, this is what this is. Like, this is what's going on. And told a mentor at the time that I thought I needed to seek treatment and was told, that's a really bad idea. You are up and coming in ministry. If you seek treatment, if you get an official diagnosis, you are totally screwed in terms of having a future in ministry. You are not going to be respected. You aren't going to be able to step forward. So I didn't, and I got sicker. Yeah.
Wow. First of all, do you ever take a moment to kind of reflect on where you've been and where you are now? Like the journey that you have been on?
Yeah. Well, and I'll get more into kind of how I got here, but I think it's interesting. I was talking the other day about if you would have asked me in 2018, if I thought I would be here, like at all, I would have told you no. So to be able to be doing this work and to be in a space of recovery and honestly, just to be alive and living my, it's crazy in the best way.
Yeah. And did you say that was in 2018? So that really wasn't that long ago.
No. In kind of the condensed version, moving out of seminary, I got my first big role in school chaplaincy, still was not diagnosed, was ordained. And I entered a really large role with 2,700 families where I was the religious leader. It was the biggest private school in the continental US, which I love. They have been so supportive of my journey. But at the time, I was coming in at age 25, first female in the role. My predecessor had been there 25 years. And I was like, I got to get this right. And nobody can know that I have this thing going on in my mind. So the very long story short is there were so many tragedies while I was there. Unfortunately, lost students that I cared about deeply. And I'm someone with harm OCD, with false memory OCD. And my OCD started to latch on to legitimate tragedies that were going on in the community. And I started to blame myself. I would stand up during funerals and think, I'm somehow tangibly responsible for this while officiating. It was pretty horrific. I got to the point where I was working in intense trauma work with kids and then going home at night and like sitting there dialing 911 and staring at the phone, calling the police on myself for crimes I hadn't committed. I mean, it got pretty low. I was very, very fortunate to get evidence-based treatment at my lowest point. No one knew that I was doing that. I was seeing a provider in secret at night while in this role. And when I got better, it was like a veil had been lifted. I was enjoying my life for the first time. I actually could step forward, and I also didn't want to be quiet about it anymore, because some of the students, unfortunately, that I had lost to their own mental health struggles, I found out had not come forward because of shame in their faith communities. And I felt a huge obligation to say, like, your religious leader in the school, your chaplain, has actually been seeking mental health treatment. So I let a group of students write an article about the chaplain with OCD and blast it out to 3,000 families without getting permission. I was like, I'm gonna get fired. Like, this is, and it was the opposite. I started hearing from families that they trusted me to tell me what was actually going on and how did they talk to their rabbi, their priest, their imam. And it was through that I started then advocating with the IOCDF and learned about religious scrupulosity. And my life kind of turned upside down, and realizing I had been working so long in interfaith roles and teaching religion and navigating OCD, and I could really turn pain into purpose, helping both clinicians and faith leaders navigating this really difficult subtype.
Yeah. Do you feel like you were maneuvering religious scrupulosity yourself?
You know, so for me, it was primarily, I think, well, and I guess I'll back up. So religious scrupulosity, there's some debate of whether do we consider it a subtype of OCD? Is it something that wraps around a lot of subtypes just based on our beliefs with a cultural factor and all sorts of different things? I think for me, there were definitely aspects that were integrated. But when I think about my core fear really is that of moral scrupulosity. My core fear is, what if I'm a bad person? And there's probably religious ties there as a minister and holding myself to a higher standard. But for me, it's always been, have I caused harm? Am I a bad person? What if I'm a bad person? So it had never, when we think of classic religious scrupulosity, where someone is engaging in ritualistic or repetitive prayer or washing or confession, that's never how it took shape for me. It was, for me, primarily ruminative and trying to figure out, did I cause crimes and, or did I commit crimes and forget them? Yeah.
Yeah. And walking around with that deep seated sense of something bad or wrong about myself.
Yeah. Well, and there was definitely, I mean, I think the piece where it does overlap with religious scrupulosity for me is, you know, just feeling so much shame about my role as a minister. And if only, how would they feel about me as a religious figure if they knew? How does God feel about me as a religious figure with the things that are going on in my head? And I can think of one baccalaureate service, looking out at like 5,000 people and my arms up and having no idea what was coming out of my mouth because I was trying to figure out if I had run over someone in the parking lot.
Yeah. And that's, I think, what a lot of people who don't live with OCD maybe don't understand about living with it. The incredible ability, really, to have this background tape playing 24/7 and yet presenting something to the world that probably looks much different. Like, most people in attendance, I would imagine, had no idea that's what was going on in the back of your head. But it's like that, it's that, like, like trying to exist in the real world and doing a really good job of it, but also like just this, these monumental questions happening internally simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I talk about this often, and different people I know have such different experiences with OCD, but for me, no one knew. I was still really high functioning, and I actually think that prevented me from getting treatment for a really long time. I mean, I could I could teach 6 hours of comparative religions to teenagers while simultaneously, as they were doing things, be Googling about every crime in Atlanta, and nobody knew. They thought I was like a rock star professor. And it sucks when I look back on it, because it's why I got so sick. It's why I hit rock bottom, because I was way too good at not letting anybody know that I hated myself.
Yeah. And, you know, another piece of what you shared was just that, that courage to step out in a faith community and talk about mental health, which, seems like such an important, critical thing to be talking about. Why? This is a massive question, I know, but why is there such a divide between that, right? Like mental health and religion.
Yeah. So I have so many thoughts. And this, of course, looks very different in different communities. And there are some religious and spiritual communities that I think are doing a great job having conversations around mental health. And there are others where it's kind of a dirty word. And I think as a whole, there's been a movement in the direction the past couple of years about, especially with COVID, like we were talking about earlier, talking about mental health. But I think there is still such a stigma around talking about diagnosable mental illness. I think often in faith communities, when we talk about mental health, it has to do with, we need to do self-care. We need to go for a walk. We need to do these things. But I have found in many faith communities, as soon as I start talking about exposure and response prevention and the why box and getting folks are like, whoa, okay, this isn't where we were going. But I don't think, and maybe I'm overly optimistic, but at least in the communities that I've worked with, whether it's in Christianity or Islam or Judaism or Hinduism, I think often it's a lack of understanding and faith leaders not having the language or the knowledge or the training to figure out how to step forward. And I think sometimes when we don't have that knowledge and we're asked really big questions, we try to answer them to the best of our ability and we don't do a really great job. So I hear so often really harmful messaging about anxiety and about intrusive thoughts. And I've been a pain in the butt with some faith communities and had some really intense conversations about how deadly that is to say from the pulpit. But generally the response actually has been, crap, I just didn't know. I didn't know this was a thing. So I like to at least give communities the benefit of the doubt that I think there are opportunities. While there is so much harmful messaging, I think there is still such a lack of awareness.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to kind of break this down. I know for a lot of people who are maybe new to learning about OCD. So you mentioned ERP, exposure and response prevention, which is considered the gold standard treatment for OCD. And there's other, you know, there's also, I think, a lot of debate around there's other modalities too that can be really supportive. And yet in the OCD community, ERP is definitely considered the gold standard, which includes things like in the case of maybe a religious themed presentation of OCD, where somebody is really concerned about, have I offended God? Have I done something that's going to lead me to this like lifetime of punishment? Or, you know, if I don't do this thing, then, you know, I'm a really bad person and God doesn't love me. And, you know, I mean, you're probably much more well-versed at talking about this than I am.
No, just you're spot on,
some,
though.
Some of the flavor of what I hear from clients.
Yeah.
And so the ERP approach to that, right, is to learn how to, we might start to lean into some practices where it's intentionally doing things that we may fear have offended God, learning how to tolerate the uncomfortableness of that and not engaging in compulsions, which I know for a lot of people, I would imagine the question comes up of like, I don't want to do these things because maybe like my faith is something that's very important to me. And I still want to maintain that sense of faith and a connection to God. And I also want to get better with my OCD. And so I feel like we start to kind of hit this like crossroads with treatment sometimes where trying to figure out where I'm going with this. Like how do we help people maintain their faith and do the work of exposures? Do you have any thoughts about what you have noticed with that process that's been helpful for people?
This is like honestly my favorite question. I train in this area a lot. I feel like I could talk about this for like 17 hours, which I promise I will not answer with 17 hours.
You can do it. We can make it a 17 hour.
But I think, I mean, there's a couple of things. I love one, letting folks know that they're never going to be asked to do something that directly opposes their religious tradition. And it's one of the things that I come on cases often to work on is navigating, kind of understanding someone someone's religious values and what their particular sect and community or denomination does, and using things like the 80-20 rule of would 80% of the folks in the congregation be kind of okay with navigating this? And that can be really helpful to let someone know, we're not going to ask you to do something that opposes your tradition, but we are going to ask you to do some stuff that's really uncomfortable. And I call it the discomfort versus disrespect principle of, we aren't going to ask you to do something that within the confines of your particular tradition, which from a cultural responsiveness perspective, again, can look so different, whether it's an Orthodox or a Reformed Jewish community and so on and so forth, but really tailoring that. But I love the idea of asking someone, once we've taken a look at your community, why don't you want to do this exposure? And it's my favorite question. And part of it comes from, we're never going to be super stoked about exposures if it's a good exposure. I've never walked into treatment and gone like, woohoo, I get to do the hardest exposure. Like, it's awesome. But the why becomes really important. If the reason they don't want to do it is, well, I'm really scared that God's going to be mad at me and that something bad might happen, it's like, yes, stellar exposure. Let's do this. If it's, this completely opposes everything in my religious principles and no one else in my community would do this, I think it's a really good space to think about, well, are we asking someone to do something that directly opposes their dietary restrictions or anything else like that? So first is letting people know that we aren't going to cross that line, that we are going to work with them, but they are going to be uncomfortable. And then second, letting them know that that discomfort that they're going to feel is not in opposition to God, but rather it is in fact a spiritual practice. So all of my doctoral research is around reimagining ERP and evidence-based treatments for OCD as spiritual practices. Because when we do a spiritual practice, it's about doing across traditions. It's about doing something really hard in favor of reconnecting with God. And that's what ERP is. It's doing something really hard, something really challenging. It's taking a leap of faith. It's leaning into uncertainty in favor of moving away from OCD and reconnecting with the divine. And as a part of that spiritual practice, I like to remind folks that if we really believe in your faith tradition that God is all powerful and all loving and all knowing, God can handle you doing this little exposure over here in order to reclaim the awesome life that you were created to live.
Wow. I still have it. I got chills when you said that, like looking at ERP as a spiritual practice. That is so powerful.
I get so excited when I talk about this. And I think probably my doctoral cohort is sick of me talking about this, but I get so excited because I watch this every day with folks that start treatment and say, I'm terrified to do this thing. And I have had the pleasure of working with so many treatment teams of folks across traditions where, again, whether someone is Muslim or Christian or Jewish or Hindu, seeing them at the end say, whoa, I'm actually connected with my faith and no longer worshiping OCD. And it's like, what a cool thing. Mm.
So hearing there that the work of doing ERP and learning how to manage that, actually deepening people more into their faith, not pulling them away from it.
Absolutely.
Which is huge, because I think the fear is oftentimes that the opposite's going to happen.
Yeah. And I understand why that fear exists. And I always tell folks that. But in my experience, when treatment's done well and when you have the right support, I've only ever seen folks get closer to their faith. Because I mean, the reality is, if you are praying 10,000 times a day or asking for reassurance or going to confession from a space of fear, anxiety, guilt, shame, you're not worshiping God anymore. It's actually about the OCD. It's about trying to get rid of that discomfort. And even if ERP leads to us doing hard things or engaging in practices less frequently than we were before, you might actually end up worshiping in a way that's authentic to you for the first time in your life. And that's pretty darn cool.
What are some of the most common compulsions that you see with religious themed presentations of OCD?
Yeah. Compulsive prayer, asking for reassurance, either from religious leaders or from God, often, particularly, I see this often in the Muslim tradition, ritual washing and making sure that we've done everything perfectly. Sometimes a lot of checking in relation to dietary restrictions, just to make sure that we've done everything right. Compulsively reading scripture. Sometimes that can be even compulsively Googling to make sure that we understand scripture appropriately. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I see that comes up the most often with that I tell folks all the time is confirmation bias, because folks are often looking for the thing that they're the most scared of. And that's the thing that they're going to keep seeing pop up in Google over and over again as they do these compulsions, is that scariest explanation. But any of these things we can see show up across religious and spiritual traditions.
Yeah. And then if we kind of like segue almost a little bit, and I know I'm like bouncing around and they're all under the same umbrella, but like the moral scrupulosity presentation of OCD, are there some common compulsions that you notice in that category?
Yeah. And I mean, they definitely overlap.
They also could be anything, right? To also point out that a compulsion could be, they run the gamut.
I'm so glad you said that. And I always tell folks, like, literally anything can be compulsive. It's like about why you're doing it. It's what's the function. With even talking about prayer, there are reasons to pray that are not compulsive and there are reasons that are, and kind of separating out that function. But with moral scrupe, so much overlaps as well, whether it's asking for reassurance from folks to make sure that you're a good person. It might be ruminating on past events to see, ooh, did I do everything right? Did I do something wrong? It might be playing out future events in your head to make sure you would handle those in the perfect, upright, moral way. It might be, even reading old messages, reading old emails, reading things that you've written to make sure you did everything right or appropriately. I mean, any can take on any of these different forms. I will say I got super creative. Maybe that's not something to be proud of, but with my moral scrupulosity, it's like, whew, I found all sorts of ways to try to prove that I was a decent human being. And I want folks to hear none of it worked. No matter how many hundreds of hours you spend trying to figure it out, it is going to feel worse than when you started.
Totally. Feels maybe good in the short term, right? But in the long run, it just digs you deeper and deeper into it.
Yeah.
As you have, it's funny, can you hear the sirens off in the background right now?
I hear it really minor. Always the noise canceling is so amazing.
Right? Very symbolic of like moral scrupulosity, right? Maybe I've done something wrong. They're coming for me.
Well, no. So it's funny that you say that. And that used to be, so my partner, Ethan, when we first started dating, we laugh a lot about my OCD. I also find OCD really funny, especially in my own life. I think humor is really important. But yeah. I had a colleague. It was when I was still really looped into what if I committed crimes and forgot. This was something that took me a long time, even post-treatment, because I had done so many compulsions for so many years to kind of fully separate from. But him and I started dating and my work phone rang and I was like, oh, it's somebody from work calling to tell me that I committed a murder. And he was like, what are you even talking about? Nobody's going to call and be like,
yeah, like just to let you know, we've discovered that you committed a murder. Yeah. That would be so kind of them to do that, right? Yeah, give me the heads up. Yeah, it will, and just speaks to the power with OCD to jump from one thing directly into a very, very worst case scenario in the blink of an eye.
Oh, absolutely.
Through this whole path that you've been on, how would you describe like what your relationship is with God? A higher power today?
No, actually, I love that question. And I think it's really interesting. I don't get asked this a lot, and I love this. I think, you know, through seminary and even through school chaplaincy, my relationship with God was still so much me trying to get it right and me feeling like I had to be in a space of perfection in order to be the perfect minister, the perfect person. Felt like I had to hold myself to a higher standard than everyone else. And I think it's been through this journey of embracing uncertainty and navigating ERP and now walking this with so many other people that my relationship with God is one of gratitude for just getting to be who I am as somebody who's imperfect and somebody who screws up and somebody who doesn't always get it right, but still knows that I am enough and that I am loved even in the midst of all of it. A lot of people in theology say that they're public theologians if they speak about theology. I say I'm a publicly uncertain theologian. I publicly speak about how uncertain I am. And I think in my relationship with God now, I'm in a space that I really believe that's okay and that I'm still enough.
I love that so much. Do you have a spiritual practice, like daily practices that bring you closer to God?
Yeah. So it shifts, you know, in different seasons of life for me. So I'm a big, with a lot of cases that I work on, actually work with people in finding what do their spiritual practices look like. And we go through lots of different things. I love writing letters to God is still a practice for me that can be really authentic and beautiful. I love prayer in more authentic conversational forms, because I think for such a long time, again, I felt very much in a box of this is what it needs to look like. For me now, it's very much like, oh God, that was really cool. Thanks for that. Like, that was awesome. But also, and this one always sounds strange to talk about, running for me is very much a spiritual practice. Actually, my seminary degree the first time around for my MDiv, my final research was on endurance athletics as a spiritual practice. And my biggest space of prayer and connection to God and connection to something beyond myself is actually when I feel my feet hitting the pavement. And that is when I do not only my best thinking, but I feel like my best connecting with God in prayer.
Love that. And you're doing incredible things with you're working towards running 50 ultra marathons, which an ultra marathon is what again? How long is that?
It's anything longer than a marathon. So I'm doing a variety of distances. So they are essentially 30 miles and up to 100 plus. I've been focusing on 50Ks, which are 31 miles. And then I'm kind of going to get into some of the longer stuff. But I do all trail races. So it's all off-road, jumping over stuff, running through streams. And for me, it's very much a spiritual practice. And it's also kind of a form of ACT, an acceptance and commitment therapy. So I talk a lot about so I say running toward my values. That's kind of my big tagline. And it's whatever is coming up today, whatever kind of icky stuff is coming up, I get to keep putting one foot in front of the other and not just moving, but physically running toward everything meaningful to me. And that's, as I do these races, really what I think about in addition to raising money for OCD. It's also just this space for me of whatever the day holds, I'm going to put one foot in front of the other and I'm going to get to that line. The last race I ran was ridiculous. It was on a beach in Texas, entirely on sand. And it was like freezing and pouring down rain. And like it had hail at one point. And it was just this like insane wind. And it was humorous. I'd been through some stuff personally that week where I was just like, what am I even doing out here? And it was the coolest freaking experience. I ended up halfway through just saying, whatever OCD is telling me this week, all this stuff that's happened, I'm literally just going to put this down and I'm just going to run. And I ended up winning the race. It was a good day. But it was one of just the most ridiculous and painful and also most beautiful days, just saying, just keep moving forward. And that's what we do today.
And isn't that so symbolic of like, that's how life is sometimes, right? The hail's coming down, the wind's in our face. And yet you showed up in the midst of that.
Yeah. And I laughed too. There was halfway through, I was like, this is so painful. It's ridiculous. And I remember a point when I just started laughing where I was like, well, we just keep moving forward. And that's what we do.
I love that so much. And ACT is like a whole other conversation that I could talk about for 19 hours.
It's
sure.
My favorite thing.
Me too. I just think that idea of, like pointing our life in the direction of our values and inviting all the uncomfortable stuff along for the ride and not sitting around and waiting for that stuff to stop before we do it.
I love ACT, and it's been such a, so the program that I'm in right now, I'm finishing my Doctor of Ministry in Integrative Chaplaincy at Vanderbilt. And it's a pretty new program for folks kind of working at the intersection of faith and mental health. So I'm the second cohort, and I kind of didn't know exactly what it was going to entail when I started it. And it's been the best experience because I didn't know the whole first year and a half would be ACT-based. And it was reimagining ACT through a spiritual lens with all of the cases that we were working on. And all of my papers were around looking at cases and like seeing ACT in a spiritual way. It was just like, oh my God.
That's amazing. Where are you doing that at?
Vanderbilt.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It's amazing. Yeah. And I wanted to bring up too, and I'm glad that you mentioned the word ick. Because stick with the ick. That's your thing, right? Like if people follow you on Instagram, they're going to see that a lot. I know you're the founder and director of you've renamed it.
Yeah.
Stick with the ick. What does that phrase mean to you?
Yeah. So, it literally means sticking with all of the icky thoughts, feelings, emotions, stuff that feels like physically just ick. And allowing that to be there, not trying to get rid of it as we keep running toward our values. I mean, for me, that's all rolled into one. And it's really this belief that by allowing those things to be there, by not trying to get rid of them and still putting one foot in front of the other, that we can live this really beautiful, awesome life. And so that kind of phrase for me, started so randomly, and it just, I don't even know, I always had, in school chaplaincy too, I always had just these little like quirky analogies and rhymey kind of things. So I started saying it on Instagram a couple years ago, and it took on a life of its own, and folks I think started to really resonate with that and have now shifted. I was doing primarily case consulting and clinician training with faith and mental health integrative services, and realized that that title was very much not me. And has transformed into stick with the ick, which everything is kind of transitioning right now. In April, I'm launching Stick with the Ick actually as an iOS app that's a full virtual community with resources for clinicians, clergy, people with OCD, support groups by faith tradition, spiritual support, consultation, all sorts of stuff. But the idea is that people across diverse faith backgrounds, people who have experienced spiritual abuse and religious trauma can have a safe space, and that clinicians and clergy can also have a safe space to connect. I will say I am in a great place with my OCD recovery.
Yeah.
And yet it doesn't mean that we don't still experience those things. I'm really open about the fact that it's something I continue to use my skills and tools every day. And I think especially, I love the work I'm doing. I am pumped. I'm excited. I think folks can probably hear. I just get so jazzed about it. And also, even for me now, OCD latches on to that. I consistently feel like my poor partner hears me all the time like, well, if I do like 5 more doctoral degrees, then I'll finally feel like I am valid in this field or any of these things. I consistently question the work that I'm doing. And I really have to catch myself through an exposure lens and say, yeah, you know what? I might not be doing enough. I might not be doing it good enough. I might not be doing any of the things right. And that's okay because I love it and it's meaningful.
And I think too, letting the barometer of growth not be whether or not those things are surfacing or not, but rather our ability to hold it right in a different way and to allow those things to arise and not get pulled into it maybe the way that we have in the past.
I love that you said that. And I always tell folks I love seeing it as an opportunity. And that's really where I've shifted in my own life. It's not recovery isn't about, do the thoughts pop up? Does this happen? Does that happen? It's all yeah. about our response. And I love now, and people think I'm super silly when I say this and work with scrupulosity, but literally when people get triggers and intrusive thoughts, I tell them, let's jump up and go, yes, I am so pumped. What an awesome opportunity to fight OCD today and to respond differently and to make it even smaller. And I don't always do that perfectly, but especially with my work right now, as I'm so excited about it, I've really tried to see any way that OCD attacks it as an opportunity to say, thanks, cool, stellar opportunity to use my skills and tools today as I keep running toward my values.
And I think too, another element of this is, like, I so appreciate you sharing that OCD and everything still shows up, because it helps me feel less alone too. Because as I've stepped into this new chapter of being a therapist, man, OCD has been loud, and there's a lot of mental noise around that. And I think sometimes we're led to believe that if we're doing almost like what we're called to do, or we're doing something that we feel really passionate about, there won't be any of that noise. And I think that's what I always used to subscribe to a lot in the past. It was like, oh, I'd try this. And then it was like, oh, still anxiety there, still OCD there. This must not be the right thing. Yeah. And then you start playing this game of whack-a-mole where you're like running away from the thoughts or the uncomfortableness or the ick. Mm-hmm. And I think to help people understand that while on the outside, it might look like all these people have all their stuff together, you know, who are doing these things with their life, like it still shows up mm-hmm. moment by moment, day by day. And it's just, can I hold it a little bit differently? And can I also understand that I think the closer that we get to our values, there's oftentimes a ramp up in OCD, because you're leaning into something that you really care about. And that's the breeding ground for OCD.
Oh, it does. I mean, absolutely. I always think it's the opposite. It's latching onto it because you care about it so much. And we joke in my house. So my partner, Ethan, who has OCD and advocates, he for most of his life was worried about something bad happening to him. And he was always, we started dating at one point. He was like, I had an intrusive thought, I'm going to murder you. And I was like, oh my gosh, you do love me.
That's fantastic. That's awesome. And so great. Yeah, you're like, that's the most romantic thing anybody has ever said to me. Well, it's so beautiful that the two of you can talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, we do. We do a lot. It's a beautiful, and it's been a journey too, because, you know, of not falling into reassurance and things like that, since we do both understand. But it has been really neat to get to advocate and kind of grow and figure those things out together.
Yeah. As we wrap up here, I know I want to just encourage everybody to check you out on Instagram. Doing such beautiful work there. I know that's a great way to follow along. I'll put a link to your Instagram page here in the show notes. I'll also link up to your website. I would love for you to share with people, like, who's a good fit to work with you, or what is it that you can best offer people in this space? It's kind of a hard question.
No, not at all. It's funny. I've been having to write this down a lot lately with this transition to the app. And so I think for me, my work has transitioned a little bit where I'm not necessarily doing like sustained cases anymore. And what I'm doing is really for any clinician, faith leader, or individual with OCD who's navigating any stuck point related to faith and OCD, either with a current case or in their own life or in their congregation, I would love, across religious and spiritual traditions, to have you as a part of this community, to jump on and help you work through stuck points, to plug you in with resources and support. So I think my community right now, I'm very big on absolutely everybody from every background is welcome. And there really are things for clinicians, clergy, folks with OCD. And I think acknowledging rather than saying, you know, there's a specific fit. Everybody's different. Their OCD is different. Their religious and spiritual practices are different, and would love to plug you into community. And if there isn't something for you there right now, would love to make it, because I want it to be a place for you.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for making time for this today. And I truly just adore the work that you're doing. I think it's so important. And I can't wait to continue to watch it unfold one step at a time, whether it's hailing or raining or you're on a muddy trail or wherever you're at out there on the path. Excited to keep cheering you on.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also, just a reminder that this podcast is not meant to replace work with a therapist. And so if you feel you need it, I encourage you to reach out to a trained mental health professional. All right, we'll talk soon.